So let's start out with the Urban Science Fellow. What are you doing there?
So the Applied Sciences Initiative under Mayor Bloomberg, it's one of the last things we did during the Bloomberg administration, was to incentivize the construction of these schools that would feed engineering talent and data science talent to the growing tech sector in the city. We wanted to home grow some more talent, essentially, because that was one of the bigger problems holding back the development of that sector, was the development of that human resource, that human capital. So the Center for Urban Science and Progress is an NYU's effort in that area to train data scientists who are specifically geared to understand urban issues.
So we in Baltimore ought to be recruiting some of the students that are coming out of that program, or at least starting one of our own.
Absolutely.
Good. And how long have you been there?
Since December, or January 1st. I left the city on December 31st, so January 1st is when I started at NYU.
So take us back a little bit and talk a little bit about data analytics, where this all started with Bloomberg, what it was like working for Michael Bloomberg.
So the Bloomberg mantra that he repeats over and over again is, if you can't measure it, you can't manage it. And to measure it in a Bloomberg sense means that we need to put in these, you know, metrics of performance. That had been going on for a long time in his company. He just took that approach and applied it to city government. So instead of trying to figure out how many terminals you've delivered at Bloomberg LP this month, you're trying to figure out how much trash you picked up or how many inspections you did or how many crimes occurred in a specific precinct, and then measure that over time and see where you could apply fixes to get better at doing that. The natural progression from that was analytics, which is to say, how do I leverage what I know at the Department of Finance to assist the fire department in its job?
Right. So, you know, CityStat is what we've had here in Baltimore. It's one thing just to have data. It's another thing to step back and create an analytics team that looks at that data and says, how can we use that data and, in fact, some correlations of that data with other data that can make the lives of our citizens better?
Yeah. And so those stat programs, it's very similar to what we had in New York. We had something called the Mayor's Management Report, which is critical indicators about how the city's doing what it's supposed to be doing, right? All those things do is tell you how it's going. They don't tell you how to fix what's wrong. But what they tell you in many ways is, this is where you should start asking questions. What analytics allows you to do is take that next step and figure out how to answer those questions and fix those problems. So, for example, a typical key performance indicator is revenue collected by the taxation department over a given time frame. That doesn't tell you from each entity what they collected, and it doesn't tell you how it was collected. That's what analytics is supposed to allow you to do, and that's why we engaged in an analytics effort. But those first things, how much did we collect and how much did we collect over the same period last year, should indicate to you where you should actually throw those analytics efforts in the first place.
And, for example, where you're collecting and where you're not collecting it. And why aren't you collecting it there? You must have enough anecdotes to take up an afternoon, but maybe talk for a minute about how the analytic capability took the data to places you never expected.
So one thing that surprised me was how strongly different parts of the city interacted with each other. And by the end, I mean, I was surprised by how highly correlated information from the Department of Finance was with catastrophic outcomes at our first responder agencies. That surprised me. For example, if there's a tax lien on a property, that showed a ninefold increase in likelihood, or correlated with a ninefold increase in likelihood of a catastrophic fire at that same location. I didn't expect to see that. But then when you actually think about it, it's very commonsensical. The kind of building that's going to go into arrears on its taxes is the kind of building that's probably going to have a lot of safety violations. And those safety violations are leading indicators of catastrophic fire. So I think what the city was doing in many ways, because services at every city are fragmented out by departments, but problems don't really care those issues are fragmented out by the departments. What analytics allows you to do is kind of bring it back together and take a look holistically at your individual problems.
At the end of the day, this is all about the intersection of common sense and technology. Is that fair to say?
I think it's absolutely fair. I think the reason we had as much success as we did in New York is because it was driven almost exclusively by commonsensical approach.
Right. Interesting. It reminds me of the old story about your chief of police, Bratton, when he looked at the high rates of crime and graffiti in the subway system, and also the high rates of turnstile jumping, and came to the blinding flash of the obvious that the people who were doing the graffiti and the crime were very rarely paying customers. And if he could stop the turnstile jumping, he could probably stop the graffiti and the crime. And surprise, surprise, he did.
And it's utter brilliance. And it's brilliant because it's an experienced officer who knew his lift and then went out and took the time to understand the landscape of the job he'd just taken on as the head of the transit police. And then just sort of figured out, well, you know, we're going at this all wrong. Why don't we just go upstream? And if we capture this activity upstream, then it has a lot of downstream beneficial impacts.
And in fact, if we take a booking bus right outside the subway station and we haul the turnstile jumpers upstairs, surprise, surprise, they're going to stop jumping the turnstiles.
Right. And it's the kind of thing I think you can explain to anybody. I don't think you need an engineering degree to understand that.
Right.
And for what it's worth, I'm terrible at math. I'm a lawyer by training.
So take us back a little bit. You did some amazing service to our country in Baghdad, and maybe tell us the story of how the service in Baghdad led you to data analytics and a career in that area.
I started my career as a prosecutor in the Manhattan District Attorney's Office, and because of my then girlfriend, now wife, was living in Washington, I had to move. So I moved to a corporate law firm in D.C., and it was an excellent law firm. It just wasn't for me. I mean, you go from prosecuting, street crimes and homicides and things like that, and, to litigating the price per unit of, like, toilet paper for major hotel chains. It's tough, right? So I got really bored very quickly, and I went to a partner one day and just kind of begged to be sent to Iraq if there was an opportunity. I assume they
you must have really hated that job.
It just wasn't for me. It was a bad fit. And so
I've had bad days. I've never asked to be sent to Iraq.
Yeah. I don't know. I have no explanation other than the fact that it just wasn't for me.
And you stayed married.
I stayed. Well, we got married while I was in Iraq.
Because you promised to stay there? Or?
No. She was with the State Department. And so what happened was when I asked and received permission from her to go over to Baghdad for the Saddam Hussein trial, she then went to her bosses at the State Department and asked to go over to work for the U.S. Embassy in Baghdad. So we ended up living together over there, and then we got married, and we took our honeymoon for all of a day and a half, and then went back to work. And my wife had worked on the Iraqi Constitution while I was getting ready for Saddam's trial to kick off.
So you took a honeymoon to Anwar.
Yeah, pretty much. I think that was the extent of our honeymoon, was like the flight back. But in any event, I went over to the Hussein trial assuming I was going to be involved in a legal capacity, but what it ended up being was a logistical thing. We had to bring in, like, backhoes from the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, for example. You have to kind of get Saddam and his cohorts in and out of the courthouse on a daily basis, as well as witnesses and prosecutors and judges, and all of this happening at a time of extreme violence. So what we ended up doing was turning to our friends in the military intelligence community, and they had this program called JADO, or the precursor of JADO. It's a classic Pentagon acronym. It means Joint IED Detection Organization. And they employed a number of different statistical methods to predict where roadside bombs would crop up. And, from our standpoint, which was just simple transportation logistics, we would just go where they said not to, we would not go where they said not to go. And those methods were fairly straightforward. It was just simply an overlay of, traffic activity in the areas surrounding the green zone and IED incidents. And they were all mapped. And then you could draw certain conclusions from certain changes in activity. And when I finished up with the Saddam trial and found myself back in the States, all I kept thinking was, well, why can't we just do the same thing for any other problem, right? Why don't we take what we know and leverage it a little bit more commonsensically, right, and convert that into actionable insight and then act on it? So when I came back to the States, I ended up on the Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations with the Senate, and that was right when the financial crisis was just starting to metastasize. And we did a number of things that were very similar, you know, with offshore tax evasion, for example. I just kind of called up the Department of Homeland Security and said, do you have, you know, the visa records for these bankers that came in and out, you know, because when you get on an airplane, you have to fill out that little form that says it's for business or pleasure and then where you're going. And why don't we overlay that with where we know a lot of really wealthy people are going to congregate? And then from there, we can sort of start asking good questions of these bankers as to why are you going to Art Basel or Art Basel, excuse me, in Miami, claiming that it's for pleasure. But in reality, at the same time, coincidentally, we had 19 people sign up for these really high net worth offshore bank accounts. That seems sketchy to me, right? So all it is just is a way to kind of layer a bunch of disparate pieces of information that speak to the same issue.
Right. Confluence of technology and common sense.
Right, right. And it was just, you know, it's sort of, it's a field that really rewards intellectual curiosity and a certain measure of creative doggedness. And if you just kind of refuse to, when you hit that wall, and if you refuse to stop and start thinking, well, instead of going through the wall, let me see if I can go around it, and then you go around it by leveraging other pieces of information. It may not say directly what you want. There was no file that said, here are the tax cheats, right? There's a bunch of different files that replicate that tax cheating activity, and why don't we just use that and put together a mosaic of that activity and then act accordingly.
And then when you ask the questions, the individuals think that you know probably more than you do, and therefore you're at a competitive advantage relative to them as opposed to them being at a competitive disadvantage.
Right. And in many ways, it's sort of a prisoner's dilemma. Right. If you're intelligent enough to leverage all of these different pieces of information, and I'm not trying to pat myself on the back here, but if you just get a little creative about how you take a look at these different pieces of information from these different sources, and nobody else is doing that, then you're invariably the warden of the prisoner's dilemma that you set up, right? And in that way, a lot of people just start of all of a sudden things just start falling into line, right? And, you know, from there, it was just a short hump from, you know, the crosstab moved from roadside bombs to financial crime and then to putting out fire.
It's right. Interesting, you know, knowing a couple of military prosecutors that have spent a great deal of time in Guantanamo, this country's commitment to prosecutorial justice, I think, is a story that probably needs to be told one time. I'm sure you watched that in action over there. The protection that we gave Saddam Hussein sounds like it was extraordinary.
It was robust. I mean, there's some things I can't really get into for reasons, I think, that because it's still classified. But, you know, there were moments in time when Saddam, for example, was and his defense team was claiming that he was on a hunger strike and, you know, was being abused while being held by the U.S. military forces. And, you know, having that kind of inside knowledge of knowing exactly what that hunger strike constituted, which was him switching to, like, Gatorade and V8, you know, and seeing just how I wouldn't call them lush, but they were housing that was significantly better than anything our troops was getting. You know, it just sort of, I think people don't appreciate just how much we went out of our way to treat the prisoners in our care extremely well, to almost at the expense of our own people.
And to create a process that was reflective of our values.
Right. I mean, that was really the most important thing. It wasn't a matter of, like, we're doing you a favor by treating you this way. We really had no choice.
Right. And, you know, to the extent that we were actually protecting him through your data from people that were clearly trying to take him out.
Right.
Yeah. It must have been a fascinating period of time in your life.
It was absolutely fascinating. It was extremely taxing mentally and physically, so I wouldn't call it fun, but it's one of the most fulfilling experiences I've ever had, and I wouldn't trade it for anything.
So let's get back to New York then and talk a little bit about the difference between using data to measure things and using data to predict things and then in fact solve problems. And where did you start out in New York? What were the first tasks that you did or problems that you addressed when Bloomberg put you in charge of the office?
So the first thing I did, my office was me. I hadn't hired anybody else yet.
Can still be an office.
So yeah. So I spent those first 6 months constituting the sole member of my office, basically kind of running through a reconnaissance effort. And that reconnaissance effort kind of went in two directions. The first was, what data does the city collect? What do we have? So I just conducted like a citywide data inventory that had never been done before. But then at the same time, I did sort of a process and history and people inventory, right? So it's one thing to collect data and it shows up like in a spreadsheet and it's a number in, you know, a line item in an Excel file. But there's a set of humanity and buildings and history and all kinds of things and processes that generate that number. And if you don't understand that, then you're never going to understand the significance of that number. So that was that sort of two-pronged reconnaissance mission. And my high-tech tool was a whiteboard. I bought the biggest whiteboard that the budget would allow me to buy. And every day when I came back from, you know, say the Department of Buildings or the Fire Department or the Sanitation Department or the Water Department or whoever, kind of wrote up, okay, this is what I learned, this is what we know, this is what the data is, this is what the system looks like, and if I'm going to try and piece together, you know, a bad thing from all of this data so that we can figure out how to prevent that bad thing, you know, this is the challenge I'm probably looking at in terms of getting access to it,
right,
and then leveraging it intelligently. So that went on about 6 months. And then also during that time frame, because a lot of it's just gumshoe work where you're just, you know, I was never at my desk. It was always out in the field. Then you hear from the people that are actually delivering these services what they're bitching about. You know, why are their lives more difficult than they could be? You know, from there you start to kind of, at the same time you're doing this reconnaissance, you're figuring out like, okay, well, this is where we could fix things. So it's very similar to what you were talking about with Commissioner Bratton. Commissioner Bratton kind of gets there and says, well, why don't we just move the purchases out, you know, onto the street? I mean, I'm sure that came from a lot of B cops telling them, this is crazy. You know, all these things are happening. Why aren't we doing this? So I don't want to kind of cast myself as somebody who came up with these great solutions. What I did was I just listened. To the people who've been doing this for years, it just that had never really kind of been percolated up.
But it sounds like the Bloomberg administration had a cadre of senior people around him that cared about the analysis of data and continued to ask questions about that data.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. I mean, it was a very data-driven government. The mayor himself every day would look up at the big tote board and say, okay, this is our response time today. Right, and this is rolling set of metrics that would roll across the screen in the bullpen, and everybody has gotten a call from him, right? Where he's like, "Why is this up? Why does it look like this today? What's going on with that?" Right, and he would ask these probing questions based on data, as would all of his deputies. The deputy mayor for operations, for example, Kaz Holloway, was fantastic. Data-driven guy, as was Deputy Mayor Steele, who's the Deputy Mayor for Economic Development, my immediate superior, John Feinblatt, who's a Baltimore native, by the way, who's the mayor's chief policy advisor. The thing that they did, in addition to creating that, you know, environment where we are going to be evidence-based in our resource allocation, was that they gave you a long leash, right? And in other words, the other thing that Bloomberg doesn't get enough credit for is it was a very entrepreneurial atmosphere where it was okay to try something different that was, you know, asymmetrical from what the, you know, local government normally did. But for Bloomberg, was it give it a shot.
And it doesn't have to always work.
No, and many times the first analytic we came up with, I would categorize as a pretty big failure.
So what was the big failure?
So the failure was we went and saw if we could craft an algorithm that would predict for us what subset of the $1.5 trillion worth of real estate transactions in the city of New York every year were fraudulent, right? The estimates were that there were 400. What we believed is that we could cull from current data, including like sales transactions and foreclosure records and things like that, building permit data, right? Those transactions that were more likely to be fraudulent and thus should be given over for some more scrutiny. That in the sense that we were able to come up with an algorithm that did that, that's very commonsensical, right? If you buy a bunch of properties and hold them and they flip in price over a period of time and you never get any construction done on them, and by the way, one of the parties is dead, you know, this is all things that the city already knew,
but and didn't put together.
Had a higher likelihood that was going to be fraudulent, right? The reason I would call it a failure, though, is that nobody ever did anything with it.
Right.
And that's my fault. That was my fault because I forgot what it was like to be a prosecutor. Because, you know, the fact of the matter is most of the victims in mortgage fraud are actually banks. And this kind of goes back to understanding the market. Like I said, it's a $1.5 trillion market. And what they were really concerned about was the ability to kind of generate those sales and securitize those transactions, right? $400 million is a cost of doing business.
Right.
So they were lousy victims. And so that because of that, and in addition, the DA's offices, I mean, it's not like they were hurting for work.
Right.
So I failed to keep that in mind. So what we learned from that was that we do know an insane amount that we're not acting on, that we're not doing things with. But I needed to craft it in a way that it was actionable, right? You mentioned a story when we were talking before we started taping here about a young woman who came up with a really fascinating portal on how to get testing results back to people. And it's so commonsensical if you think about it, right? She just kind of came up with a portal to allow you to do it instead of having to show up and sit there and wait all day at the clinic to get your results. This was very similar. I forgot that last part when we had our first analytic effort, right? So the mayor, of course, was, okay, well, at least we learned something here. Now go fix that, right? And so when our very next analytic was about building inspections, and I was always mindful of who was ultimately going to have to act on this insight as I was crafting the algorithm in the first place.
But the critical thing is that you were surrounded by a group of people in City Hall that had the intellectual capacity and intellectual interest to keep asking questions.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And good, tough questions.
Right.
You know, sort of... when I was in law school and you were doing this practice for oral argument, they used to call it something called a murder board, where you would go before a group of peers who would pretend to be judges and then just grill you on everything that could go wrong with, you know, your argument. The thing that I liked about City Hall was that it was a constant murder board, right, where you had these really effective, intelligent, probing questions that were coming not just from the mayor, but from, you know, the deputy mayors and their staffs, you know, the chief of staff, for example, also a Baltimore native, for Deputy Mayor Holloway. She's brilliant. And she asked these magnificent questions as to, you know, okay, what are you doing? How are you doing it? What is this going to help us with? And you could always tell a lot from them just by virtue of the fact that they were asking these great questions, and it invariably made the product that much tighter. So I really benefited from fantastic leadership.
Yeah. Must have been a very rewarding place to work.
Yeah, I love that job. I love that job primarily because it was the best group of people I've ever worked with. The excellence and the public-spiritedness as reflected in making sure that you're outcome-driven. It's like nothing I've ever worked with.
That's great. All right, I'm getting the... Mike, thank you for joining me.
Oh, thank you for having me. I'm sorry I rambled a little bit there.
You didn't ramble at all. You have more exciting, interesting things that are relevant to Baltimore than really many, many, many of the people that I've spoken to over the years. It's the implications of what you're talking about for our citizens of Baltimore are profound, and lessons that we need to learn from you and put to work in Baltimore about the confluence of not just data collection, but asking questions and creating a culture of analysis of that data is really, really important.
Yeah, I mean, the parting thought I would have is that, frankly, anybody can do this. It's simply a matter of leadership and will and not accepting things as they are.
Well said.